Friends, please, let's ask for a blessing. Father in the heavens, thank you so much for this lovely Sabbath, good friends, lovely songs to express our appreciation for your greatness. Please prosper my efforts to share some insights with the saints today. We pray for your blessing upon us. In Yahshua's name always. Amen. Hallelujah. Well, I really am fired up getting up here now. You know, as I was preparing to come forward, my soul was bathed with waves and waves of these glorious musical offerings. For some reason, today's offerings really touched a nerve for me. As especially note the last one we just sang, the Revelation song. I always love that. Now, my favorite version comes from Sister Jennifer Foliard. I hope someday we can pull her out of retirement and have another offering from her, because her version is my favorite. I should also give thanks and gratitude to those of you who bring snacks, foods, drinks, and other things. Sometimes I don't know who made that yummy dish that I scooped up at fellowship meal. I don't know who to thank. But there are times I wish I could go get an operation where they give me two bellies and I could enjoy more of these things that you bring before us. I appreciate every bit of it. I remember the first feast I went to in 1980. I knew only a few people. I knew some, better than none, you know. And I got a lot of mileage going around with a hangdog look on my face, playing the Hungry Bachelor. And I found the saints were always generous in that regard. My remarks today are called The History of Common Sayings and the Common Error. And I noticed talking to some of the people about this before getting here, they would stumble over the common error. Okay, there's a preacher out there who was joking around. He called the transition of the Old Testament faith to New Testament faith, it was the common era. And he would call, instead of BCE being before common era, he'd call it before the common error. And instead of calling this AD, he'd call it CE, common error. And so, yeah, what is that error? Well, I'm going to give you an idea of what I think the common error is. But on the path to getting there, I'm going to talk with you about some common sayings in English, and so showing how they have a connection to the Bible. There's some sayings we all know where they come from. Go the extra mile, that comes from the Sermon on the Mount. Turn the other cheek, that comes from the Sermon on the Mount. Now, I didn't have time to work these others in there. Like father, like son, it appears to come from the Bible expression. Like mother, like daughter, or something. Yeah, like mother, like daughter. The skin of your teeth, that's mentioned by Job. I think it's a reference to those cashmere sweaters you wear on your teeth when you get up in the morning. You have the feeling of cashmere sweaters. It's like a thin skin of something. We all have an urge to brush it away. I'm going to talk about a handful of sayings, and then we're going to come to one of them, which is sort of a window, a portal, into a saying that's pretty well known, but it has an ugly history. And I'm going to use it as a way of tying into the early Messianic faith, how it was corrupted by the Roman Church anciently in late antiquity. And there's so many great things I learned when I was a Catholic. But, you know, as time goes by and we do research, we find there's some things they could, would, and should, correct. It seemed good to just quote a passage from the past. Jeremiah 6:16 seemed appropriate. Thus saith Yahweh, stand in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths. Where is the good way? And walk therein, and you shall find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk therein. In our quest for the truth, in our quest to pursue restoration ministry, we often feel compelled to go to the past. If we go far enough into the past, we'll find the original traditions, the original truth, the original customs. We're going to look at several common sayings and look at how they either came from the Bible or find verification in the Bible. And then toward the end, we'll look at one common saying which betrays an unpleasant history and even points to a significant profound change in the original faith, a change calling for restoration. So we're going to start with some quiz-like introductions here of these. In the Bible, there's the statement, "I am holier than thou." That's in the Bible. Now, sometimes people will project that saying on us. It might have happened to you when people who are in a sort of a mainstream walk may find out that you observe the seventh-day Sabbath or something. They might take resentment with that. "You've given me this holier-than-thou attitude." They might impute that to us. And we typically try to train people to be ready for that and not to react negatively. That image there is taken from an old magazine from before the turn of the previous century. And the picture is called La Hypocrisia. And it's an image of a cat weeping over the illness of a rat. And he obviously doesn't care about the rat. He's a cat, you know. But hypocrisy is, in the Greek, it means to speak from underneath. And that means underneath a mask. And so this business of wearing a mask became a description for hypocrisy. "I am holier than thou." That's imputed to people who are presumed to be walking in hypocrisy. Where did it come from? In the Bible, anyway. Did it come from the proud and arrogant Pharisees? Did it come from unconverted Jews? Perhaps that expression is nowhere found in the Bible. Well, you know it is because I'm giving a sermon on it, right? But how about answer D, an Israelite caught in paganism while looking down on the true worshiper? That is, in fact, where it came from. It's in Isaiah 65, verse 5. You know, this is the one passage for which I didn't burn the words into the... Hey, can somebody hand me a Bible? Can somebody bring me a Bible? Hold on, please. Look at this. Hot on the job. Okay. Thanks, Liliana. Yeah, this is the one passage I hadn't gotten around to burning in there. But at the end of Isaiah 65... I really thought this idea of "I am holier than thou" was an expression of hypocrisy. Well, there's a little more to it. Isaiah 65, we're looking at the locus of verse 5. "I am sought of them that asked not for me. I am found of them that sought me not. I said, behold me unto a nation that was not called by my name. I've spread out my hands all the day unto a rebellious people, which walketh in a way that was not good after their own thoughts. People that provoke me to anger continually to my face, that sacrifices in gardens and burneth incense upon altars of brick." Okay, brick, that would be man-made stones. Remember, that's forbidden. "Which remain among the graves and lodge in the monuments, which eat swine's flesh and broth of abominable things is in their vessels, which say, stand by thyself, come not near to me, for I am holier than thou. These are a smoke in my nose, a fire that burneth all the day." So this is actually uttered by a pagan, well, an Israelite who's turned to paganism. And he looks down on everybody else and says, "I'm holier than you." And that was kind of a surprise to learn that. That's where that phrase came from. How about the expression, "the good die young"? It is demonstrated in which Bible event? The invasion of Israel by Assyrians? The death of King Jeroboam's son? The death of Abel, or the discovery of the cup in Benjamin's sack? How many people think it's Let's see if anybody knows. How many believe it's answer A? Okay, I get one back there. How many think it was answer B? See, about 5, 6 go up. It's okay to raise your hand, don't. Unless it's dirty. Okay. How about the death of Abel? All right, there's one. About the discovery of the cup in Benjamin's sack. I'm relieved to know that nobody put their hand up. Okay. Well, let's look at the first one, Isaiah 57, 1 to 2. The Assyrians are about to invade. And Isaiah writes, this appears to be Yahweh speaking here, the righteous perishes and no man layeth it to heart. And merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. This terrible invasion is coming. Our people are going to be slaughtered. Mysteriously, some people are dying. In fact, good people are dying before the invasion even occurs. He entereth into peace. They rest in their beds, each one that walketh in his uprightness. There is in this Bible, you'll find it here and there, this principle that it's uttered by a number of characters. They say, I know something really bad's coming down, but I'm not going to see it. My eyes are not going to behold this evil. I remember I got into a phase where I was watching a lot of World War II videos, and I found that I had to limit and stop watching documentaries about the Holocaust. I couldn't take it anymore. And people who've been through wars, they tell you, you don't want to see this. There's nothing glorious about it. All your battle plans go sailing out the window as soon as the first shot is fired. It's just mayhem and carnage. But that's not the passage that specifically conveys the idea that the good die young. How about the death of Abel? Well, he was on the young side, we think, but he was a grown man when his brother murdered him. You know, when it comes to Benjamin's sack, Benjamin was not killed in that story. This saying, the good die young, appears to come from 1 Kings 14, verse 12 to 13. If somebody wants to give Sister Lily her Bible. Okay. Now, here's what's going on. King Jeroboam's son is really sick. And it looks like he's sick unto death. And this child is unexplainably ill. And he sends a messenger to the prophet Ahijah to ask whether the king's son will survive this lingering illness. And the prophet's answer to the messenger contains some serious theology. He says to the messenger, "Arise, go into your own house. When your feet enter the city, the child shall die. And all Israel shall mourn for him and bury him, for he is the only one of Jeroboam who shall come to the grave, because in him there is found something good toward Yahweh, the Elohim of Israel, in the house of Jeroboam." Now imagine you're the messenger, and you know as soon as you enter this town, perhaps probably going through the gate is the demarcation point. You know, as soon as you do that, the child's going to die. Maybe you'd wait a day. Just hoping the kid could live an extra day, but you have to carry the message to the king. There are some lessons to be learned from this. Proper burial is important to Yahweh. And we teach this at YRM. We urge people not to pursue cremation. We find this in many places in the scripture where Yahweh puts value on people having a proper burial. But Yahweh looks on the heart, and that's another lesson here. Yahweh even looks on the heart in little children. And this is why I'm, now that I know this from scripture, this is why I'm, one reason of many, why I'm very willing to put all judgment in his hands. If he's able to look upon the heart of a child, that's drilling down deep. And sometimes the young are taken before they can endure further temptation. Those of you who know me well, forgive me for twice told tales, but I knew a lovely young lady in Chicago She was my first tutoring student. And she was a practicing Christian. She was an Adventist girl. And she was very bright, very dedicated, excellent musician. She, if she could pass the math score in the college prep exam, if she could get a high enough score, she wouldn't have to study math for the rest of her life. And she was very happy about that. So that was our goal, and she did achieve that. But toward the end of the curriculum, I knew where she was going. I recognized her excellent spirit. And I said, look, Kelly, you're a bright girl. You're attractive. You're popular. You're smart. I punched out. I was on the clock as a tutor, but I punched out. I said, I want to tell you something. I want to speak for people who are not endowed with the gifts you have. When you go to college, you're going to be drawn to the in crowd. You're going to be popular, attractive, peppy, interesting. I'm going to speak for those who don't have what you have. I'd like you to make time for them. I want you to give them some of your spirit, some of your energy. Give them some attention, especially those who are not part of the in crowd. And I remember her looking up at me with that blonde hair and those big brown eyes. She was looking at me like she's really paying attention. I didn't know if I got through to her or not. It turned out she died in a fire. The fire never touched her. She died from smoke inhalation. And this was at the dormitory. And what happened is she foolishly went back for some things in her room. Now, I warn people everywhere I can. People start talking about, oh, what would you go back to get in a fire? I tell them, don't go back for anything. Don't go. You think, oh, it's safe. There ain't no smoke there. It's safe. No. There's toxic fumes in those fire zones that you can't see. In fact, some public announcement videos will have you, they'll instruct you to walk, or not walk, to crawl on the floor just to get away from those toxic fumes. We lost that lovely young lady to those stupid toxic fumes. What was really profound was at the funeral service. Had all these people coming forward and saying, I was a janitor. She made friends with me. I dished up food in the canteen. She made me feel like I was her best friend. She was a disciple of Yahshua, wall to wall, floor to ceiling, coast to coast. I could see where Yahweh would take her. Like, look, this kid has achieved a level of mastery. Maybe we don't have to have her face any more temptation, you know? Well, anyway, I'm not endorsing or celebrating the loss of any young person, but the good die young. There is something to be said for that, that Yahweh keeps them from temptation. And how about it, those of you who are in late middle age, pre-retirement, you know how ugly life can get. Let's move on. True or false? True or false? The scapegoat takes all the blame for the sins of Israel and is thus slaughtered. How many believe this is true? The scapegoat takes all the blame for the sins of Israel and is thus slaughtered. Maybe you'd be afraid to raise your hand, huh? Because, you know, but it's true or false. Ooh, who wants to be wrong? No, it's wrong. Now, in our society, when someone is implicated for a crime they never committed, let's say there's a group of people or politicians or activists, and they do something naughty, and one person is merely connected to the problem or the events, we tend to call that person a scapegoat. You might hear somebody say, I'm just a scapegoat for all their mistakes. Well, if you look at the word scapegoat, it's kind of related to the word escape, isn't it? You know? It is true that the scapegoat in Leviticus 16, 7 to 22 has all the sins of Israel confessed on it in verse 21. Now, you have an image there. There's actually two goats. It's not too clear. But there's a priest there casting lots. He's rolling some stones on a table. And based on the result, he's going to take one goat, and he's going to pronounce all the sins of Israel on that goat, take him to the wilderness, and let him go. And he escapes. the scapegoat is sent away while another goat is slaughtered. And for decades I've known this, and I could never understand how somebody could say, I'm just the scapegoat for all their mistakes. No, the scapegoat gets away. You know, I never. So what I think what they're saying is all of their blame is on me. But in those political contexts, the scapegoat is also getting punished. But the scapegoat gets away. And now the symbolism speaks to a spiritual reality. While Satan will be banished from the kingdom, it is Yahshua who takes the eternal punishment, even though he has no guilt. That's what's really in the Bible. The point is driven home when the criminal Barabbas, meaning son of the father, is chosen for release by the people prior to choosing Yahshua for public execution. Okay, here's another one. I welcome this one because I treasure this. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. This comes from which source? We're going to have a little fun and games here. Raise your hand if you think any of these are true. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Does it come from modern marriage counseling manuals? Does it come from common sense? I don't think so, because a lot of people violate it. About Ephesians 4:26. Well, that sounds so precise. Maybe that is the answer, right? How about Dr. Phil? Now, it comes from Ephesians 4:26. Be angry and sin not, let not the sun go down on your wrath. You know, guys, I've been really urging all of you, when I get a chance up here or in everyday conversation, I'm urging you all to embrace the divine order of Matthew 18. This verse tells us to fix things fast, real fast. You think about it. If you got like roughly 12 hours in a day, plus or minus. And let's suppose the average conflict emerges at midday. You typically have 6 hours to wrap this thing up. But what I see sometimes, you know, looking back, I was baptized at Trumpets 1980. And looking back, sometimes instead of having things wrapped up in 6 hours, things are still dripping and drabbing out there 6 years later. I mean, dragging on and on. Yahweh bless those among us who rapidly get their anger resolved. Not managed. I'm not into anger management. Get their anger resolved. Get that stuff wrapped up. And the very best method is the one that you are least inclined to follow, and that is to go direct. I've heard that in the business world, it's common for wise managers, when they get wind of a conflict between two people, they drop everything and get them in one place. Say, okay, what's going on? What's going on? And so often it's a misunderstanding, or it's a, maybe they put one priority above another. You know, and even if there is some character flaw at play, when human beings engage each other, and they see each other as human, the anger dissipates. Yahweh bless those couples who resolve their anger before they go. By the way, the image there in the corner, that's King Shaul raging at David playing the harp. And that was hate without a cause. The guy didn't do anything. Oh, wait, one other thing. Let's look at that scripture. Be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. If you don't look at that right, it'll sound like it's giving you the go-ahead to be angry. All right? That's not what it means. It says don't sin. Now, there's a tiny number of situations where anger is appropriate. All right? And I think it's healthy for children to fear daddy getting angry or mama getting angry. I think kids should have a little fear there. But that stuff has got to be controlled. It's got to be carefully measured. And it's got to be wrapped up before sunset. May Yahweh bless us in this. May Yahweh deliver us in this. Okay, this is the one we're really building up to. There's an old saying out there, when in Rome, do as Romans do. Where did this come from? Let's see a show of hands if any of these answers ring true. When Paul says we should be all things to all men, does that mean when in Rome do as Romans do? How about we must follow the crowd even when it is evil? Is that anybody? Okay, nobody. Roman practices are endorsed in the Bible. Does anybody believe that? Okay. So where'd this come from? Rome had a tradition of fasting on Saturdays. Now, it turns out this is a saying that has a connection to the Bible, but it's not in the Bible. We're going to invest considerable time in this saying, when in Rome, do as Romans do. And by the time we're done, maybe you will reject this idea as enthusiastically as I do. But let's look closer at all of them. Paul says we should be all things to all men. I'm going to read that passage because I love this passage. Look at this. I did it again. It says, in a hurry, I failed to fix some of the names and titles. Okay, for though I was free from all men, I bought myself under bondage to all that I might gain the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew that I might gain Jews to them that are under the law as under the law. Not being myself under the law that I might gain them that are under the law to them that are without the law. As without the law, not being without the law to Yahweh, but under the law to Messiah, that I might gain them that are without the law. To the weak I became weak, to that I might gain the weak, I became all things to all men, that I might be all means save some. Before I talk about the next one, when we make an appeal to others, we want people to know, I'm just like you. In most ways, I'm just like you. And to establish some common ground is a very wise thing. And Paul found himself pivoting from one kind of person to the next. Like when you like these Bible studies you're doing down there with the letters to the Corinthians, Paul is really struggling to get these Gentile believers on board. And of course, being so well educated, he was able to relate to them. But we have to be that way. And I want us all, when we have newcomers arrive here, we should all work at trying to establish some common ground with them. I don't want anybody to be left behind. Okay, no matter how different they are than me, there's going to be something in common. How about we must follow the crowd even when it is evil? In Exodus 23:2, it says, you shall not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shall you speak in a cause to turn aside after a multitude to wrest justice. This is obvious. You don't follow the crowd. Okay, I had a situation like that come up recently, where I was tempted to follow a crowd, to sign documents that were untrue, documents that everybody else was signing. And I had to say no. Now, I'm hoping to resolve that issue with the people involved. It's not with anybody here. But it's not enough for them to say, well, everybody else signed it. No. If there's a falsehood in there, I cannot put my hand to it. How about Roman practices are endorsed in the Bible? Show of hands? Don't make me laugh. Come on. There's no endorsement of Roman practices in the Bible. It comes from a letter from Augustine. Now, the document itself I'm quoting from is called St. Augustine Letters, Volume 1, Letter 54, to Januarius, around 390 A.D. Augustine says, when I go to Rome, I fast on Saturdays. But here in Milan, I do not. Do you also follow the custom of whatever church you attend if you do not want to give or receive scandal? That's where they came from. This Roman church that he visited had a tradition of fasting on Saturdays. And we're going to drill down and get to the history of this. So we know where the saying come from. But where did the practice come from, the practice of fasting on Saturdays? Now, I'll give you a quick review. We'll find it happened in parallel with rejection of Sabbath, emergence of Sunday. It lasted for a few hundred years, and then it died out. Here's what happened. Background for me. We're doing a broadcast series called Saints Through the Centuries. And I go up there and I talk about the historical forces that caused the change of Sabbath to Sunday, for example. How the Roman Church also forced a change from observance of Passover and unleavened bread to Easter. Those of you who are just tuning in and getting acquainted with us, the historical data verifying this Sabbath early on for believers in the Messiah, that historical verification is crushing. It's overwhelming. It's so obvious. But right along with it, I mean, right there, often in the same pages of history, there's verification that they also observe Passover and unleavened bread. But they also document turning it into Easter and turning true Sabbath keeping into Sunday. And this is something completely manufactured in the Roman, through the influence of the Roman Church. Just go one step farther. I'll only go one step farther. You don't have to work hard to do any historical analysis of Pentecost because they kept Pentecost. And there are churches to this day which observe Sunday Pentecost. One of the reasons it was easy to keep is because it was already on a Sunday. You know, so there was no debate or action. They just kept it on Sunday. They retained its observance on Sunday. But in the course of doing the research, you stumble across this thing. There was a bizarre practice of fasting on Saturdays, and they kind of traveled in parallel. These developments followed a growing ferocity in turning away from anything that looked Jewish, such as Sabbath keeping. So let's take a look at factors which led to the rejection of anything that looked Jewish, including Seventh-day Sabbath. First, the Jews persecuted early Messianic believers. A lot of Jewish leaders, I don't mean all Jews, a lot of Jewish leaders beat us up pretty bad. They did. They killed us, and Paul went house to house. Shaul, before he was converted, went house to house, brought us out and had us killed. The Jews themselves were often in trouble with the Roman Empire, and especially after the fall of Jerusalem. The rebellion in Jerusalem really put a black eye on the Roman authorities. They were shocked at what good fighters the Jews were. They were not a pushover. And the Romans came to really hate Jews. And a lot of Messianic believers started thinking, hey, if we act less Jewish, we'll get out of the line of fire. And so hate for Jews became common. There's more to it. I'm going to give you a more detailed summary. But this is the common error which led to much evil, much distortion of the original Messianic faith, this hate for Jews nonsense. These are two items from the presentation I just recorded. It'll be up on the internet sooner or later. There's a fellow named Hippolytus. He was an author within the early Catholic tradition. He had an expository treatise against the Jews. In part 6, speaking of Jews, he says, "And surely you have been darkened in the eyes of your soul with a darkness utter and everlasting. For now that the true light has risen, you wander as in the night and stumble on places with no roads and fall headlong as having forsaken the way that saith, I am the way." I mean, who would go out of his way to sit down and write out something against the Jews? Think about it. This guy got pieces of paper and parchment, whatever, and he says, I'm going to do an expository against the Jews. What would motivate him to do that? And this was only, well, we don't know when he wrote it, but it was somewhere between 170 and 235 AD. There's another one, John Chrysostom, from 347 to 407 AD. He was particularly intense against the Jews. Now, some of this language is kind of harsh. In this homily number one, Against the Jews, part two, here are some excerpts. But do not be surprised that I called the Jews pitiable. They really are pitiable and miserable. When so many blessings from heaven came into their hands, they thrust them aside and were at great pains to reject them. But now see, thereafter, the order was changed about. They became dogs and we became the children. It kills me to read this. Here's another. If then the Jews failed to know the Father, if they crucified the Son, if they thrust off the help of the Spirit, who should not make bold to declare plainly that the synagogue is a dwelling of demons? G-O-D is not worshipped there, heaven forbid. From now on, it remains a place of idolatry, but still some people pay it honor as a holy place. Now, I didn't insert it in here, but Paul writes that we are grafted into Israel. And he says, don't you go boasting against the main branch. You are grafted into Israel. You know, you're just some wild branch who is grafted in. You know, if anything, we're the dogs, right? Yahshua endorsed that analysis, huh? We're just some stinking Gentiles, unless you got some Jewish blood in you, okay? But I know that we have reasonably a lot of our Hispanic brethren have Jewish blood. I mean, the rest of us are a bunch of stinking Gentiles getting grafted in. I'm an Israelite, but I have to remember, I'm just grafted in. I would never dare utter these ridiculous claims. But this is evidence. This is just a snapshot. This is evidence of the growing anti-Semitism in the Roman church. Now, it's worth spending a moment to talk about the distortion and erosion of the original faith. It had several components. There was the loss of apostolic leadership. When the apostles died out, we lost a lot. Now, the fall of Jerusalem is also significant. History shows that Jerusalem was coordinating all the international missionary work. And, for example, I often talk about the missionary work of Thomas the Apostle, but that was coordinated from Jerusalem. After the fall of Jerusalem, Rome emerged as a religious center. It's significant that Polycarp from the Eastern Assemblies was keeping Passover, and he went to Rome to try to talk them into keeping Passover instead of Easter because they already made their decision. And they says, no, we're not going to change. And Polycarp, who was a disciple of John the Apostle, Polycarp went back to the East defeated. But what's significant is he went to Rome. That's evidence that Rome was emerging as a power center. Though he couldn't run to Jerusalem because there was nothing going on there. And then point D, there was a loss of genuine Jewish leadership. Now there's a early Catholic author named Epiphanius. He wrote that everything was pretty stable under the leadership of 15 bishops ordained by the apostles. And these bishops were all Jews. As long as those guys were alive, things were pretty much under control. But he said, after the circumcised bishops passed away, chaos broke out in the calendar. And that's when Rome seized control and says, we're taking control, this is how it's going to be. But that loss of genuine Jewish leadership, the Jerusalem assembly's gone, the Jewish leaders are gone, this allowed an emerging hatred for Jews. Further, there was a cultural tendency in Rome towards veneration of the sun. You can't get around this. Sun worship is all over the place. Then you had Emperor Constantine's alarming influence over the faith. Now, when I was doing research for that broadcast series, Deacon Lucas kept coming to me and said, Brother Mike, you can't... I'm paraphrasing Lucas. I hope I don't mischaracterize it. His message was, don't underestimate how much Emperor Constantine influenced the Roman church through the Council of Nicaea and other forces, other factors. I didn't doubt what Lucas was telling me, but I didn't know the depth That same guy, Epiphanius, that I mentioned a while ago, he acknowledged that Constantine also propelled them to change Passover to Easter. And there was this unwarranted change in the Sabbath and the Passover, which is one of the components of the distortion and erosion of the original faith. Let's have a little fun and games here. Let's do a little politics. We're not supposed to talk about politics up here, but I'm going to talk about it in a fun way that's safe for everybody. I got a photograph of all the presidents going all the way back to John Kennedy. Okay? Take your pick. I want each of you in your heart and in your mind to decide which one you would trust. I kind of trust that guy. Yeah. And then which ones you would never trust. One you would never trust is one you would trust. Okay? Just on a personal level. You know? Now, on the bottom there, you see Jimmy Carter. You see? I'm confident my remarks will be safe for this forum. But Jimmy Carter, he just passed away. And this was a thoroughly decent man. Everybody liked him. I did not like his policies, except it was a gift from heaven, the Camp David Accords, to establish peace between Israel and Egypt. And the missing ingredient was for Israel to surrender back the Sinai Peninsula. They didn't want it anyway, okay? But that was a tremendous achievement. And any of you who are interested in that kind of thing, look at a decent documentary. You find that the master stroke was a last-minute idea to get Anwar Sadat to come to peace with Israel. I think it was Anwar Sadat. I'm pretty sure it was. But by the way, Anwar Sadat was assassinated for that because there are people who wanted war. But I didn't think his policies were, as far as the economy and other things, I didn't think they were all that wise. But what can you say for a man who was the most powerful man in the world? And then after he stepped down as president, he started building homes for the homeless. What can you say for a guy like that? I don't mind losing an argument to a guy like that. Okay, but there's others up there. there's actually a number of them who I think were decent men, or I liked them, but I didn't like their policies. There's some I would not trust at a personal level. There's some I would trust at a personal level. I want you now to do some soul searching. Which one in particular say, man, I would never trust that guy. And which ones would you say, yeah, I could trust him. I could relate to him. Okay, now, which of these would you trust to modify your religion? Now, I asked you to identify which one you'd trust at a personal level. Which one of these guys would you trust to charge in there as president and say, hey, let me step in there and help fine-tune your religion here, bring it up to date? Now, which one would you trust? How about this guy? Well, we've been developing this liturgy for so long, I'm sure most of you know who that is. That's Emperor Constantine. I wouldn't trust that guy for nothing. Now, the lettering is kind of small here, so I'll have to read it off. Constantine claimed conversion to Christianity in 312 AD. He claimed to have seen a vision of a cross, and he went back into the battlefield and killed people and all this. We don't know if it was a vision in daytime or if it was a dream at night. Now, what I want you to see here is a timeline. Okay? In 312, he claims conversion. In 313, he issued the Decree of Milan, which ceased all persecution of Christians. Now, what really happened is he decided to stop persecution of all religions. And we just, our fellow believers, to whatever level we have fellowship with them, they sort of tagged along. I suppose we too, even if we practice our religion there, we would have been free from persecution. Not too long after, in March 7, 321 AD, Constantine declared Sunday as a day of rest for the empire. In 325 AD, Emperor Constantine later convened the First Council of Nicaea. And that became Nicene Christianity, a style of Christianity forged by, I know they had a number of issues there. And there's a small number of things they decided would look pretty good, but much of it was evil. Now, I'm not speaking for YRM, there's nothing dangerous here, but there's something from a prophetic standpoint that's worth considering. You notice in the Revelation, Yahshua says he hates the works of the Nicolaitans. Anybody remember that? He hates the work of the Nicolaitans. Nobody really knows who these Nicolaitans are. When you drill down through commentaries, a lot of it is speculation, best guess, educated guess. I'm going to throw another one out there for you. Nicaea was named after some king's wife, Nicaea, something like that. And she in turn was named after Nike, the goddess of victory in the Jewish pantheon. Well, the name Nicolaitan means the laity of Nike. Okay? Is it possible the book of Revelation was looking ahead to the council at Nicaea? The literary and etymological connection is unmistakable. And that's why whenever I hear of anything coming out of the Council of Nicaea, I go, well, I don't know about these guys. You know, Yahshua talked about the laity, the gathering of the Nicaeans, right? Well, he calls this thing, and history shows he's always in there, sticking his nose in, urging them to go in this direction or that. And then that's confirmed by Epiphanius, one of the Catholic authors, that flourished sometime after that. Then there was in 380 AD, the Edict of Thessalonica. Emperor Theodosius I made Nicene Christianity the official state religion of the Roman Empire. This included punishment of those who disagree. Sorry for the typo there. So do you see the timeline? Now, somewhere from 343 to 381, Sunday is officially endorsed by the Roman Church and Sabbath keeping condemned. So it's not clear whether five should come before six or vice versa. I'll give you more details on number six in a bit. But finally, in 416 AD, Pope Innocent I, he doesn't sound too innocent to me, but he decreed Saturday to be the feast day, a fast day, in his final epistle, number 25. Okay, let's look at, I'm going to skip number one. It's pretty well established that Constantine claimed conversion of 312. But here's the decree of Milan in 313. When we, Constantine Augustus and Licinius Augustus, met so happily at Milan and considered together all that concerned the interest and security of the state, we decided to grant to Christians and to everybody, you note that, to everybody, the free power to follow the religion of their choice, in order that all that is divine in the heavens may be favorable and propitious towards all who are placed under our authority. Now, it is understandable that unsuspecting Roman Christians, worn out from persecutions, saw this development as a miracle. But it still was anything goes. And I'm always afraid of a philosophy that says, oh, everything's the same, everything's equal, everything's okay. Because often you find that agents of evil get in there, and once they get the upper hand, they shut everybody else down. Just like, there are political activists today who, in previous generations, were all for free speech. But some of those same players today want to shut down free speech. It's really odd to see how, like, once they got the upper hand, okay, now's our chance. A little more on the Constantine Decree. We've heard this many times. I'm just going to read it to be complete. On the venerable day of the sun, let the magistrates and people residing in cities rest, and let all workshops be closed in the country. However, persons engaged in agriculture may freely and lawfully continue their pursuits, because it often happens that another day is not so suitable for grain sowing or vine planting, lest by neglecting the proper moment for such operations, the bounty of heaven should be lost. So he's saying, look, Sunday's a day off for everybody. But if you live in the country, you're allowed to go out and do farming. So it's kind of a Sabbath, but it's not a Sabbath where you really restrain yourself. Okay, point four. Emperor Constantine later convened the First Council of Nicaea from May to August of 325 AD. Now, it's pretty well known that he was very much involved with that. And it's well documented that he urged them, for example, to change Passover to Easter, other things. Now, this Edict of Thessalonica from Emperor Theodosius. Now, maybe I should have put Theodosius's image there. But since I put so much blame at the feet of Constantine, I'm just going to leave his image there. I'll just give you a personal moment here. The research I had done for the broadcast, it affected me for a while. It shook me up inside to know, to see in history, real life, in real time, the developments and the declaration that, yeah, this is what we're doing. Yep, we're going to go in this direction, this new strange direction. Okay, here's the Edict of Thessalonica. It is our desire that all the various nations which are subject to our clemency and moderation should continue to profess that religion which was delivered to the Romans by the divine apostle Peter. Well, that's a bunch of baloney right there. Peter would have never told them to do these things. As it has been preserved by faithful tradition, I believe that, which is now professed by the pontiff Damasus, and by Peter, Bishop of Alexandria, a man of apostolic holiness. Oh, yeah. According to the apostolic teaching and the doctrine of the gospel, let us believe in the one deity of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Oh, let me skip over that. We order the followers of this law to embrace the name of Catholic Christians. But as for others, since in our judgment they are foolish, madmen, we decree that they shall be branded with the ignominious name of heretics. In other words, you do it our way or you're a heretic. And shall not presume to give their conventicles, I should have practiced this. We shall not presume to give their conventicles the name of churches. They will suffer in the first place the chastisement of the divine condemnation, which means the Almighty's going to get you if you disagree with us, and the punishment of our authority in which, accordance with the will of heaven, we shall decide to inflict. In other words, we're coming after you. And this launched hundreds of years of persecution, all kinds of persecution. Okay, step number six, Sunday is officially endorsed and officially enforced by the Roman Church in Sabbath keeping. Now, this comes from a book called The Seven Ecumenical Councils by Phyllis Schaff, a selected library of the Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers. There you go. Everything pivots around Nicene. Of the Christian Church. Subtitled, the Canons of the Synod held in the city of Laodicea in Phrygia, Pecatiana, in which many blessed fathers from diverse provinces in Asia were gathered together. Now, this crazy council lasted 18 years, 38 years. Yeah, from 343 to 381 AD. Now, this is just one section. This is in the Bible Hub. If you go to BibleHub.com, you'll find this. Canon 29, that's Roman numerals 29, okay. Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, rather honoring, I hate to say this, the L-O-R-D's day. And if they can, resting then as Christians. But if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema from the Messiah. So here it is, late in the 4th century. They lay down the law. Finally, now, here's the deal. There's a lot of references that will state this. It's hard to find one that captures it. What you have to do is go find it in Latin, and then somebody translates it for you. But here's one such reference. In 416 AD, Pope Innocent decreed Saturday to be a fast day. In his final epistle, number 25, section 4, he says, "Certainly it is evident why we should fast on the Sabbath." And he went on to explain that we should fast on the Sabbath because Messiah was in the tomb at that time, and that makes it a sad day. He taught that we fast on Sabbath out of sadness and then celebrate on Sunday to honor the resurrection. Now this citation was lifted from, Protologia Cursus Completus, Series Prima, Series Number 1, Volume 20, so on and so forth. It's in there. But it was translated by a guy named Kelly MacDonald, Jr., the president of the Bible Sabbath Association. But there are several references that cite this. In other translations, they'll talk about how Pope Innocent compared Judaism to the true Christianity. And suddenly this practice of fasting on Saturday emerged. So here I provide a summary again, but I don't think I have to go through it. But what I want you to see is the timeline. 312, Constantine's converted. 313, he lifts all persecution of everyone. 321, he has the Council of Nicaea, where he changes a lot of things. He declared Sunday as a rest in 321. And the Council of Nicaea, 325. The Edict of Thessalonica by another emperor makes Sunday the original, the official Sabbath, not the original. And somewhere from 343 to 381, Sunday is officially enforced by the Roman Church. Sabbath keeping is condemned. And finally, Pope Innocent makes Saturday a day to fast. The trend is to distance themselves as much as possible from anything Jewish and to crush the Sabbath and make it a day of fasting was another attempt to push that far away. Now, it would be very time-consuming to put up here what I'm going to mention now. As you poke around these references, you find that one of the reasons you needed these decrees, because there was a whole heap of us keeping Sabbath holy. This is not a game. It's not a gag. I'm not making it up. There was a whole lot of us in the early hundreds keeping seventh-day Sabbath. And they needed all these decrees to kind of keep us down. But I want you to think about the timeline again. If Augustine was Saturday fasting in 390 AD, remember, he's the guy who started this, when in Rome, do what Romans do. If he was fasting on Saturday on 390 AD, and Pope Innocent made it official in 416 AD, then he was making official a longstanding practice in Rome. He's trying to, like, get it out there. Make it to bake it in. History shows that many Christians resisted the Saturday fast because they still regarded the original Sabbath as holy. Oh, whole bunches of us. The Saturday fast, I'm really condensing a lot of history, but the Saturday fast was repealed in Canon 55 at the Council in Trullo, 692 AD. So they had hundreds of years of this nonsense, and it was controversial. But it still took a while to bake in the retraction of the Saturday fast. I'm almost done. Where's the moderator? I want to make sure you're ready. The common error is the disdain of anything resembling Judaism. That really is a consistent theme. It actually, it almost creates an odor of its own. This led to rejection of the Sabbath, persecution of Sabbath keepers, and persecution of Jews. And just recently I saw a nice brief summary of some of the atrocities committed by the Roman Empire, most often at the prodding of a pope or the initialization of the pope. Some of these things are unspeakable. Women and children being slaughtered, having unspeakable things done to them because they were Jews or because they were like us. I'm going to give a summary now. Several sayings and expressions have some connection to the Bible in their origin. But the research of one saying, in particular, shows a surprising parallel to the change of Sabbath and of spring feast days. Now, this is an appeal to those of you who have not, you know, jumped on board with us. This is an invitation. You know, we really desire to get things right here. And we don't want to condemn anybody. You know, I don't want this to be invitational. Like, come on, we've done the research. You can verify things for, you know, with us or on your own. But as you contemplate and weigh out the claims of our restoration message, do not fall into the error of rejecting anything that, quote, sounds Jewish. Yahshua and the apostles were Jews. Sometimes people ask me, what is this religion of yours? And I often say, one of the things we do is we do communion, as it is sometimes called. We do that only once a year at Passover. We reenact parts of the Last Supper because the Last Supper was a Passover. And always, everybody who hears that from my lips always says, They kind of light up. They realize, that's right. That's what it was. Well, I thank you for your kind attention. And I commit to you a contemplation of these things. Yeah, some of these sayings have crazy origins, don't they? May Yahweh bless you and pour his grace upon you. Hallelujah.